Welcome to the Cotton Specialist Corner Podcast. I'm Steve Brown, Extension Cotton Agronomist at Auburn University, and with me are Drs. Fred Borland from the University of Arkansas and John Snyder from the University of Georgia. So welcome, guys. This is a follow-up discussion to our last episode in which seed quality was the topic. And because this is such a complex issue, we wanted to have a follow-up conversation and focus on seed physiology and the heritability of the different traits that seeds possess, and to, related to the issue of performance, and that is the all-important task of stand establishment. So we also established, and I think everyone easily recognizes, that seed are a living organism, and so that brings a set of challenges in and of itself. And given the architecture of the cotton plant, its growth patterns and timing of the development of fruit, there's considerable variability on seed and fiber, and variation can occur with fruiting branches, the nose, the fruiting position, even maybe within the lock. And so seed production as well as fiber production is biology and not manufacturing. And so this process is not nearly as consistent as making something like nuts and bolts. So there's a lot of interacting factors that have an impact on the seed we ultimately put in the ground. So let's start by talking about some of the performance-related traits that we can measure in seed, seed size, germination, and oil and protein content. So I'll let either of you start by saying, how consistent are these traits within a variety that we purchase at a store, at a supplier? Got different bags, different lots. How consistent are those by variety?
I think it's somewhat remarkable that within a bag that they're as consistent as they are. Yet, if you start fine-tuning in it, there's a tremendous amount of variation, even within a commercial bag. But, you know, time they go through their grading and all of that of the seed, and I really contend that our commercial folks put out a lot better quality seed than it was a number of years ago. It used to be a mess, what the seed did send to me in variety testing. But there's variability. Certainly could be variation between plants, or certainly, I think perhaps within a variety, there's probably more variation on a single plant than there is between plants because of it's an indeterminate growth habit. So you got much difference in the age of the boll. And with that differential in age, you've got different type of environments that boll or that seed is developing. So there's a lot of difference there. Then we get on down, I think I mentioned last time, even within an individual lock, what position it is, whether it's up on the tip or at the base or in the middle, will affect the kind of the shape of that seed. And I don't know if it'll affect much of the quality of the seed, but it'll definitely affect the size of it and the shape of it.
I'll interject here that in our first study with the Beltwide Cotton Seed Quality Project 1.0, we collected different seed from farmers and compared the performance in the field as well as all the way to yield. And I had one variety, and I'm just recalling these roughly from memory, but seed count per pound, which is a very crude number, which is probably where my level of science is, but we had seed counts like 6,000, 6,200, and then we, of that same variety, we had one over 7,000 seed per pound. And interestingly, of those three lots, the 7,000 or whatever it was, 7,200 or whatever it was not the lowest yielding of those three. So
that's a very small seed.
That is an extreme. I've never seen one over 7,000 until that day. But so we can see variation in a variety, as you see by lot, by different lot numbers. And you've made the point that we see variation by place where that fruit or that boll is produced on the plant. And even, as you said, within the lock. How about, John, I know you've worked on oil and protein content. What kind of variation do you see there?
Yeah, so the protein content does seem to be pretty strongly influenced by environment. I would say the oil content, as a concentration, like as a percent, that seems to hold pretty true within varieties. Like you seem to see a lot of that, but even that ratio can vary depending on, you know, when there was stuff that was done decades ago where you know, they showed that the ratio of oil to protein varied depending on when, you know, they did sequential harvests, right? And even that can, like environment, development, all of those things can affect that ratio. Because especially, in fact, the more bowls that you have on that plant, the more competition you've got for those resources as well. But I would say, you know, of the seed that I work with, and again, I get most of mine from, you know, commercial, well, seed suppliers, right? And they've done a lot of work prep before it ever gets to me. Right. So I would say within that set that the oil percentage is probably pretty strongly influenced by variety. It comes out pretty consistent.
And we do have to admit that if we receive it as a university scientist, I would expect that the company is going to give us pretty good stuff, if not their best stuff. So and we do see variation, but still we get good seed for the most part. So it does seem that management and even growing environment is going to have an impact. And I think maybe later in our discussion, we'll talk about regions where seed are produced and how that might impact seed and what we realize in the field from that. So one interesting question I think came up last time is the seed coat. So talk about the genetics of that and the environmental effect of that. Fred, you can begin, but John, you feel free to jump
well,
in.
I can tell you everything I know about the genetics of seed coat real quickly. There's really not much known. I think one thing you have to recall, the seed coat on a cotton seed is much different than certainly our other agronomic crops. You know, your corn, soybean, it's almost of a opaque, you know, thin layer. The cottonseed coat is actually kind of woody, is much thicker in that regard. And as a result of that, when that embryo is forming inside there, a lot of times there'll be air spaces that will develop. And as a result of that, we have different densities. And that's why sometimes we'll float seed and get the light ones out. That's because of that variation in that those air spaces between the seed coat and the embryo. There's also that seed coat will vary in thickness over the seed. If you go up on the chalazo end, the broad end of the seed, that's where it's the thinnest, and that's where water is normally imbibed. We've done quite a bit of work on imbibition rate, how fast water's imbibed. And pretty much what we've found is that the faster it imbibes water, is probably that's an indication of its deterioration. It'll deteriorate much faster. It's more deteriorated. As it deteriorates, some of the restrictions to imbibition are gone. Is that right, John? Am I saying that right?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if we look at some of the work that, like I said, that was done, you know, years ago, seeds that tended to have that hard seed coat trait. In other words, they were, I guess what you would say is they were resistant to deterioration, right? But they were also resistant to imbibition, right? And they were restrictive to germination. So yeah. It's kind of an interesting.
It's a sliding curve there. You know, you can have a genetic hard seededness. And what that is that inside the embryo, the chalazo, where the water is supposed to be imbibed, it'll form kind of a waxy substance that prevents water from being imbibed. I worked with some seed technologists down in Mississippi State early in my career, and they were that we were working with the hard seededness. And what they found is had a student put these hard, genetically hard seed into water, leave them there for a month, and they wouldn't germinate. But you go in and just with a pen, prick them, and just overnight, they'd germinate. That's that physical restriction. There's also can be a hormonal restrictions to germination. I ran into this with some, you ever heard of the hard dormancy they run into in West Texas sometimes? I'd never heard of it until I ran into it head on with one of my varieties, is that the seed produced a relatively low germ, both cold and warm germs, but the tetrazolium test was extremely high, which meant it good live tissue, but it just wouldn't germinate. And Norm Hopper was a seed technologist out there at Texas Tech for many years. He's retired now, but he concluded there was just a hormonal factor that would inhibit germination in there. They could never figure out just exactly what caused it or how to break it. The best thing, if you run into it, just send those seed on to the mill. You know, don't worry about it. Unfortunately, my experiment station, we ended up selling some of that seed and got a black eye over it. I found out about it very well.
Two questions on this issue. When we're talking about hard seed coats or thick seed coats or seed coats that restrict or limit water uptake, is that what dormancy is, or is dormancy something else also?
Well, dormancy can be two different things, right? It can be, and actually that's some of what Dr. Boylan's referring to. When we say dormancy, it's when we take a seed that's viable and we put it in favorable conditions and it just won't germinate, right? And that could be a physical restriction, which is some of what we've talked about here, but also in that cotton seed coat, even in seeds that, you know, they don't retain this dormancy for long periods of time. If you take a freshly opened cotton bowl and you get seeds out of it, that, you know, there's a little short window immediately there where that seed won't germinate, and it's a chemical issue, and it's abscisic acid that's produced in the seed coat, and then it diffuses to the embryo. But it seems like it's either wet, you know, that seed can be dried and stored for about a month, and it'll do fine, that same seed. But what I think what Fred was referring to is something that was much more of an issue than just taking seed and, okay, you dry it out and you let it sit for a month and it's ready to go. This was something that would not germinate, right?
We tried several different things, some hot water, some freezing it, dropping it from a high. We tried everything and we couldn't break it. And Norm Hopper said that he had tried many more things than we did and was not able to consistently. And it's just a thing they occasionally run into in West Texas. And he had some suggestions of what caused it. I don't recall exactly what, but it can be a real detriment to identifying seed, what their quality is.
Well, John, you said something that the seed may require some time before it can germinate, even in an open bowl. And that's a good thing for us. And we see, unfortunately, sometimes in our part of the world, we get a lot of rain and we get extended rainfall, overcast conditions, we'll see seed sprouting. And that's a terrible thing for us.
That confirms that you got good seed quality.
Because it'll grow pretty quickly. So, all right, one other question I want to circle back and ask this question that you brought it up, Fred. I've heard of people testing seed by the water method, I'm sure that's not the appropriate name, where they float seed and the bad seed they scrape off the top. I've never seen anybody do that. I've heard of it. We'll talk about that just a minute.
I don't know that it's used much now with the dilute acid methods, but back when we would put seed into acid, then into neutralizing, and you basically have seed submerged in water. Very often people would take those floaters off, and that's what that is there. It's okay. Not really a test. It's just you take ones that they would have more airspace, they're lighter seed. As I understand, what I use is a seed cleaner that's based upon air. It blows the air up to a funnel and the light seed blow out. And I think that's the most common used in cotton seed, much better than a gravity table is used to separate different qualities of cotton seed.
But can the seed coat be affected significantly in the ginning process?
Absolutely. I think I've forgotten her name, was on
Lori Snyder.
I'd like to have a little more discussion with her, but I thought that was real interesting. And I suspect that's related to the thickness of those seed coats. And also, if they're deteriorated, I think they'll get cut more. That's a pretty abrasive process of going through a gin, and you get a little bit of a little hole, then you go through acid deleting, the acid gets imbibed into that seed, and it can cause some big issues.
That was actually, when I was kind of looking through a few things for this talk today, a really good resource is that 1986 cotton physiology. I know we're always doing new things, right? But it's important to see what was done before. And it was really interesting. You kind of see this linear relationship between the decline in percent germ and the percent mechanical damage. And they looked at seed moisture, you know, so higher moisture seed was more prone to damage as it went through the gin stand. The rate at which they were ginning, right, that was linearly related to damage. So I think there's a lot of really good work that was done decades ago. I think what Lori's doing is looking at the type of damage real specifically, and kind of relating that to how likely is it that seed's going to germinate or even survive, right?
Do you recall, did they relate seed size, the number of cuts?
Now that I'm not sure. No, I don't think so. I think it was moisture. It was, they did a lot of work, but I don't know about seed size.
Yeah. I think I mentioned before, my PhD dissertation on seed and seedling traits in cotton. And one of the things one of the measures we did was cut seed coats, and it was all over the board. It's not a real good consistency, but you think the larger the seed, the more likely it's going to be nicked. But I think it's more the integrity of that seed coat more than necessarily the size of it. It got factors of how well that fiber adheres to the seed coat, and therefore how aggressive the ginning has to be. So it gets to be a whole different science. It's quite remarkable.
So clearly ginning can have an effect on seed quality, but mm-hmm. I want to back up or maybe go forward in the process. I know, Fred, as a breeder, you've got to do some acid delining in your own lab. Right. So give us just a layman's simple description of that process.
Well, the cotton seed has fiber on it, which is a good thing. That's from an evolutionary standpoint, that was a dispersal mechanism. Kind of think of the old cottonwood trees and the floating, what are they called? Arils? Is that right? Is that the term?
I'm not sure.
Anyway, I'll call it that and nobody will know the difference. So anyway, that's seed dispersal. And that was initially God's intent of putting fiber on cotton seed, is to allow it to be dispersed. And obviously that works real well. And for years we worked with, you've got two types of, you've got the fuzz fibers and you have the lint fibers. The ginning process will take the lint fibers off when we gin it. Then we have the fuzz fibers that for many years we just lived with. When I was a kid, we planted fuzzy seed. I remember going out in the barn and nothing is more difficult than trying to scoop fuzzy seed. It just doesn't work well. But we put it in a hopper, and in the hopper, there was a little hook that would turn as you went down the road, and basically put out a rope of seed. That's all the metering we were doing. You just try to get the seed in the ground. And then when it came up, you went out there and chopped it and got it to the stand you wanted. We started in, I guess, in the late, probably early 60s is when acid delining came into the Delta region. It's kind of interesting. It came in down around Stoneville. I think they had processed some seed out in Texas, and they brought us, look at these nice, clean, little, beautiful seed. And several farmers bought the seed, and they planted it. As they were planting their fuzzy seed, they went on and planted some of that. And it just happened that year, a cold front came in, and those delented seed had germinated a little bit, started imbibing and germinating a little bit faster, and got clobbered by that cold spell. The fuzzy seed sat there for a little bit longer, and it was several years before they convinced farmers that delenting was a good thing after that experience. The delenting process, we used to use just a concentrated sulfuric acid. You dip it in there and burn them off and neutralize it and dry it. It's a big, long process. Most of the commercial now is with a dilute acid, either dilute sulfuric acid or hydrochloric acid, and which are much less injurious to the seed itself. Yeah. Have any nicks, from the ginning, then that acid's going to get in there and you'll burn that embryo.
Much like it would burn a cut on you and me.
Yeah, well, a lot of times you'll see cotyledons got little, after the plant comes up, got holes in there, particularly around the edges, kind of burn. That's from the delenting, where the cotyledons were wrapped up inside that embryo and got burned.
Okay, now one side question as well. Those fuzzy seed, you called it fuzzy lint. Is that the same thing as linters?
Okay. Yeah, fuzz fibers or linters are the same. Okay.
And that's actually sold in moats, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. All right. Now, this is a question for you again, Fred. I look back into the late 1990s with some of the first transgenic varieties. We had a year or two in which we saw cotton that had damaged radicals. And rather than a single taproot, we had multiple fibrous roots coming out kind of from the side. The cotton had a tendency to lean. And obviously, it couldn't withstand the stress that a normal plant was. And I've always wondered, was that possibly related to the delenting process and thin seed coats or something else?
I think it possibly two primary reasons. One is when we were going triple nickel, real small seed, in their normal delenting, they probably hadn't delented that small a seed before. And I suspect may have gotten a little bit of burn on there. The acid, but that will cause that radical tip to be messed up a little bit. And when it does that, you get those fibrous, those type of roots coming out. The other thing is when triple nickel first came out,
This was not triple nickel. This was before. I'll say a brand since it's not widely planted now, but Paymaster. It was planted in the lower southeast. So it wasn't.
Oh, you're talking about the 12 series?
Yes, yes, okay. Yes.
Well, they're all owned by the same people now anyway. So that changed my story a little bit. You messed up my, I had a good conclusion there. Let me finish up with the triple nickel.
Sure, sure.
We were so desperate to get the BTG that I think some companies, they sold every seed they had and didn't matter what quality. I accused them of sweeping them off the floor, what they sometimes would send me.
Fred, come on.
The Paymaster, those are some materials that are related to some of my lines.
Oh, it's your fault.
Well, maybe, partly. And partly Bob Bridges' fault, too. I got that one from him. So anyway, I don't know what specifically was going on without having more details there.
Okay.
But they would be a larger seed. They wouldn't have been a small seed.
Yes, yes. They were not small seeded. That's right.
No, they would have been larger seed.
Okay. All right. Speaking of longevity of seed, I know with the seed company, sometimes we felt like that two-year-old seed was actually better than first-year-old seed. Any thoughts on general viability of seed and commercially or just observational or otherwise, either one of you?
Well, I ran into something just here recently. We were cleaning out, we had a freezer where we store some seed, broke, and started cleaning out the seed out of there. And there was some seed that was produced in 1997. And I thought, well, there's no way those things are. We put them and they still had about an 80 or 90% germ.
Wow.
If seed are kept dry, that's the main thing. Cold, hot doesn't make, I don't think makes that much difference. But if you keep them dry, it's phenomenal how long they'll last. But here at our Georgia, Arkansas, Alabama, we can't keep seed dry very long if they're outdoors.
Now, that was one thing that if you look at storage time and germination percentage, and it really... You know, and again, this is going back to stuff that whenever, you know, you had seed stored all over the place in different warehouses and all of this, and it depended on where the storage facility was as to how quickly that germ would drop off. In some of them, it stayed pretty stable for years, you know, and then in others, it would decline after, you know, a couple of years.
Well, Luther Bird, who was my major professor on my doctorate, he and with some others had developed what was referred to as seed quality curve back in the 1960s. And what they found, if you take seed just freshly off the plant that has no deterioration, germination will actually increase as they're exposed to heat and moisture. Up to a certain point, then they'll, you know, come down as you would expect. So he divided into quality unconditioned, quality conditioned, and deteriorated, three stages of seed development.
Okay, John, speak about deterioration. What's going to deteriorate a seed?
Yeah, so I think with weathering, if you've got, obviously that seed, if the extreme example, this is not really so much deterioration, where if we're talking about weathering and you get seed sprouting, well, you've got a good seed there, right? But it's just not where you want it. But yeah, just weathering in general can cause deterioration, and especially if you get microorganisms in there that are degrading those reserves. So one of the things that might happen as you get weathering, and this is, you know, for example, on the plant or wherever, you'll see that the like the free fatty acid content will go up, and that's because you've got the breakdown of those oils that are in that seed and breaking them down into those free fatty acids. So the quality of that seed will decline, especially if the plant's exposed to weathering. And it's really interesting because, you know, when you look at seed production, you know, having seed produced in these environments that are a lot less prone to those types of issues, those types of weathering conditions, I think has really helped a lot, right? If you look at, you know, some of the older material, they were just talking about, oh, you know, people were thinking about producing all of our planting seed in these environments like Arizona and California and all of this stuff. There was still some of it being produced, but not all of it was going there. But I mean, there's a reason it's grown there as well, is to prevent that, also to help prevent that deterioration on the plant. And so some places are just not going to be as good as as far as a seed production environment for those reasons.
One of the big surprises that I've had in my career, I moved over here to Kaiser in 1997. Before that, I had my, well, when I was in Mississippi, I ran into what you were talking about, sometimes seed germinate in a bowl. I did my, when here in Arkansas, I did my seed increases down at Roar, down southeast Arkansas. And seed quality could be a monster some winters, some falls. And after I moved up to Kaiser, I moved my seed production up here, and I've yet to run into a real bad seed quality year. That just a few hundred miles farther north, the temperature, particularly temperature and perhaps moisture too, makes a monster difference in development and deterioration of that seed.
Okay, let's talk about what deteriorates a seed. Is it obviously rainfall? And John used the term, as well, Fred, weathering. Mm-hmm. Surely rainfall does that, but does heavy dew cause weathering of the seed as well?
It can if you get a bunch of them, but initially, if you go out there right after the bowl opens, you get a heavy dew, and the water will beat up on that cotton bowl. And the reason for that is there's waxes in that primary coat of the fiber, and it just kind of beads up on there. But, you know, if you keep getting continued dews, several days of heavy dews or some rain, then that wax, isn't that right, John? It basically dissipates, and then you got germination paper holding the seed into the bowl.
Exactly. That it's more about the time that bowl is exposed to those wet conditions, right? So if it doesn't have a chance to dry off, right, then you end up with a much bigger problem. Yep.
Okay. So the worst places in the U.S. to grow seed, I'm going to rank them like this: South Louisiana, Southwest Alabama, and South Georgia. I don't know if y'all agree with those, but just the humidity, the rainfall patterns, we don't want to grow seed in those regions. We typically, as John alluded to a few moments ago, Arizona grown seed was a big mantra, 30 years or so ago. That was where premium seed were grown. Now I think we grow seed primarily in West Texas, Arizona, sometimes in California, and then sometimes as a backup in the Mid-South. Do y'all have any data reflecting seed quality differences among production region of the seed? Anybody have data on that?
I do not. Within the main commercially produced regions, right? Like right. Among the right. different regions. No, I don't have that.
Any data, Fred?
It's probably there, but I can't come up with it.
I thought at one time with the company, I felt like at times we didn't see much difference. Some years I thought we saw better seed production from California, but there's some reasons we don't grow seed in California in a big way. Why is that? Or two, probably. One of them is expensive, probably more expensive than the other locations. And the second, there's always been some concern, or there have been more recently some concerns about moving some certain diseases out of California. So that's sort of limited production there to some degree. So, all right, Fred, you said something to me in an email. This may be too complicated for me to understand, but you said when studying inheritance of seed traits, one must remember that seed coat, that is maternal tissue, and that the embryo are not from the same generation. Explain that and then hash around some of the implications of that.
Well, where I ran into this again was on my dissertation. And if I'm working with seed traits, seed coat trait, what would be the F1 generation? It wouldn't be what I made across. It would be the next year. There's an interaction of generation, but that F1 seed's got F2 embryo inside of it. So that's just from a genetic standpoint, you really have to be cognizant of that as you work with that. But that's more academic. In terms of, from a practical standpoint, I'm not sure there's a lot of, I mean, just to know that it's more of a genetic factor rather than, production issue.
So again, a more scientific something of interest, but not no big implications now.
I'm pleased that it interested you.
Okay. Well, how about this one? This also interested me. I've always thought of the acid delineated seed is called black seed, but you introduced something different in our last conversation. Explain that. I thought it's all black, but that's not true.
Well, they're called black seed, but there's variation in color. And again, I got in on my dissertation when I was doing the cut seed. I'd use some color charts and try to differentiate different seed coat colors. You know, they're just to the naked eye, they range from kind of a brown to dark black. And I couldn't get anything from the color charts. So we did just a visual rating and saw some differences, some genetic pattern there. But I didn't really find that it was really connected to anything. Only problem you get into, if it's a real light brown, you probably don't have a fully mature seed. And there's where it gets to be a big issue. But from a genetic, just genetic, from a shade of brown to a shade of black, I don't think there's really anything different there.
Okay, John, I've heard you've explored some effects of management on seed quality, seed issues, even PGR applications, row spacing. Discuss some of that. Talk about those issues and their impact on seed quality.
Yeah, so the PGR, this was sort of a surprise for us. We were doing PGR work because we were interested in other things. We were looking at nutrient uptake and all kinds of other things. But it just as sort of a standard practice, we do some yield component assessments. And while we had the seed there, we went ahead, we got seed index data and these types of things. And it's turned out to be one of the more consistent responses that we've seen, you know, year after year is in our PGR. And when I say that a little more specific picks, Mapaqua chloride treated plots, you know, we tend to produce larger seed and significantly larger seed. Mm-hmm. We've seen that in PGR by fertility studies. We've seen it in irrigation trials where we've had different PGR effects. You know, across the board, we tend to see where we manage plant growth with PGRs, we have, you know, larger seed. And I can't help but think that has more to do with when you, you know, constrain that growth. And again, I don't, in terms of the bowl numbers and all of that, I'd have to go back and look, but I'm assuming that, you know, you don't have that bowl distribution scattered out as far on the plant. And it could be just that, you know, because we do know that as you move to those higher positions, right, the best positions tend to be in the middle of the plant from a seed quality standpoint. But yeah, the larger that plant is, you're going to have bowls of all different sizes and ages, and then there's competition for resources. And I think that may draw the size down a little bit. And so that's why we consistently see this. That's my guess anyway.
Do you think such observations would hold when we move to our commercial seed production areas of California and Arizona? I'm going to guess, and again, this is ignorance on my part, I'm going to guess that West Texas is not a big PGR use area. I suspect Arizona and California clearly are, but I'm thinking out loud here. So talk about
that. Yeah, so I'll go ahead and just chime in here. If we've got, just like what we've seen in our trials, if water is the thing that is constraining your growth, then the plant's not going to respond to PGRs as best we can tell, right? Because it's already being controlled from a water perspective. And so in Texas, if we've got, you know, if we don't have aggressive growth, because from what I've seen, it varies obviously year to year. We can't just say across the board, but definitely that'll vary by production environment. But if you've got aggressive growth, I think in those scenarios, obviously controlling that growth would have a positive impact on seed size. Now, the composition of that seed, we're just now running some of that data because we've saved it from a few of these years of these studies, and we're running that now. So the composition, we'll have data for that, but for sure the seed size is affected. But you're absolutely right. It's going to depend on what is the growth potential of that environment.
There is some seed production in the Mid-South, and that's kind of a backup. Fred, is there much production that you see, or you're too far north to see much? Is that true? Talk about that.
There is some. Some companies will contract for some development of seed, particularly if it's a new variety, they're having a hard time getting seed of it, they'll do that. But it's always kind of undercover. We never know exactly what's going on. You've been with seed companies, you know how that is. There's some aspects of that, but I've heard of different producers will contract to produce seed for different companies. A big issue there is how do you keep it separated at the gen, and some purity factors involved. It's kind of fun. John mentioned this, these early bows, not as good of quality. When I'm old enough, we handpicked cotton back in the 50s. And if my dad was planning to save seed, we would take that first that we picked, those first opening bows, we'd take that on gen, then we would get our seed production out of the, you know, the middle part of the plant, the second picking.
You already knew where the good seed was.
Yeah, so. I guess so.
Okay, let's move on to this subject. Last time we differentiated, or you guys differentiated between seed vigor and seedling vigor. And then after the session, I reflected on my data collection from the past, because I always valued ratings of about 21 days after planting to assess what I call vigor. And it made me question, was what I really assessing, was that seedling vigor and not seed vigor? So obviously both are important, but the second measure means little if the seed vigor is terrible. So do they trend together, or talk about that some?
I think John and I kind of came with some different messages last time. So we may have different messages. Well, first of all, seedling vigor depends on seed vigor. If you don't have good seed vigor, you're not going to get good seedling vigor. It's going to be a slower germ. It just doesn't have the health to get going. And I work with my graduate students, as I mentioned before, we basically define seed vigor as a resistance to seed deterioration. It would maintain its germinability for a longer period of time. And then we broke down seedling vigor into three factors of how fast it would develop its true leaves and no longer be a seedling, its seedling disease resistance, and then its rooting capabilities, which is an area I think we have sorely ignored. And I think I mentioned before is that what we found with some of the seedling root is that lines that develop greater amount of seedling roots would actually be a little bit shorter. And I assumed that was because it was different. It was taking its energy down to produce roots rather than the epicaudal part of the plant. Now that's more observational. I mean, we had data that supported that observation, but I'm not sure what exactly was going on there. I kind of questioned when you go out and say, this is a good vigor seedling, it's, you know, it's taller. Well, that's not necessarily, you know, I think John looks at dry weight, and that's getting closer to what vigor is. It's got dry weight, but I think you have to take in conjunction that what's going on underneath the ground to really call that a vigorous seedling.
And actually that kind of leads me to, I know we're jumping ahead maybe talking about roots here, but you know, that was one of the things that we did. And again, keep in mind that this isn't from a breeding program perspective. This is from I've worked with really the varieties that we would have in the on-farm variety trials. And so we were looking at seed characteristics and how those might influence seedling vigor. And so to avoid the issue of, you know, to distinguish between seed and seedling vigor, we essentially selected seed that had already germinated at a specific time. And actually, that was Fred Borland's recommendation there. So they already had a radical protruding there, and then we would plant it.
I started to say I used to do that. So I don't.
Hey, I didn't come up with it myself. I'm not that smart. So yeah. So what we did is we did that, and that's when I had the student in here that was doing the root work. And actually it was kind of interesting that, you know, it was a combination of things that were affecting the vigor of that plant. The seed size tended to be pretty predictive. You know, the oil and protein, the energy content contained within that seed, but also some of those had a unique root anatomy where they tended to produce more secondary roots. And in our study, yeah, the shoot growth and the root growth were pretty closely, not pretty closely, they were linearly related. But we had varieties grown under optimal temperatures and cool temperature conditions. And so when you have low temperature, that slows the growth of everything, right? So, you know, just across the entire data set, the two were related. If I was just isolating the genetic portion, like just looking at the varieties only, I might have seen a different trend, right?
Okay, let me ask this question. Can a variety have good seed vigor, but poor or marginal seedling vigor? What do you think about that? John, I see you.
I think it's a possibility, but in part of the definition of seed vigor is we're really wanting seed that'll germinate and emerge. I believe that's part of the definition of seed vigor. So it is possible, I think, but I think if you have low seed vigor, then you'll have lower emergence. Now, the individual, I'm just trying to think here in a situation where, you know, where the two would be really disconnected. Obviously, one will affect the other. Can you give an example where the two are disconnected there?
Well, you mentioned maybe just prior to your coming to UGA, and maybe it was 2011, and I do remember this happened, that you had an extremely hot year and extremely dry year, and there were varieties, particularly the small seeded varieties, that did not come out. They did not successfully establish a stand. Now, whether that was a seed issue or a seedling issue, that's kind of what I'm asking. And that's a related question, and both of you can respond to this. If we put seed in the soil that's excessively warm, what happens? And if it's dry, my observation is if it's dry and we get rainfall 3 or 4 weeks later, we get a good stand. But y'all talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so I get what you're saying there. So I want to make sure that, you know, the seed, we have seed germination, and then we have seed vigor. We look at seed germination. It's a pretty good indicator of seed quality, I would say. That's, you know, and so it's going to germinate, right? The seed will germinate, but then once it germinates, it's really in that seedling phase, right? So it germinates, and then it's got to get up out of the ground. So, you know, one of the things that we saw was we had seed lots that had high germination percentages, not just, you know, not just warm germ, but even their cool germ. And I'd have to go back and see what they were, but they were well above anything that, you know, we would consider, you know, not just the base level. These were pretty high rates of germination. So it didn't seem to be related to seed quality at all, but you could have them growing side by side and have pretty enormous differences in stand establishment. So you would have some that just wouldn't make it to that soil surface. And I think when you talk about temperature, and that may be a separate thing that you want to discuss there, but with temperature, I mean, the way I think of it, because we had another year similar to that after I got here, you know, years later, and I had a larger seeded cultivar here, and I had a smaller seeded one right next to it, and I got nothing over here where the small seeded one was, and stand establishment looked just fine, you know, where the larger seeded one was. And we had these extreme temperature conditions. And the way I see that is that you've got, you know, a plant that's got essentially less fuel available for growth, right? And if you've got less fuel available, as you increase the temperature, that plant is burning more carbon to do the exact same amount of work. And so it basically runs out of fuel before it makes it to the surface. And that's more of it's still a seedling thing, but it never emerged, right? So seed quality is good. Germinability is good. I may be a little off on some of the terminology here, but the seedling itself never makes it to the soil surface.
We're really talking about temperature or soil temperatures. As my recollection, you might correct me here, 110, 115, that be in the range? And maybe it would take multiple irrigations to get it up. And so you almost had to continually water it to get it up to a successful stand. So,
And then that also becomes an issue. You know, we had fields where we didn't have crusting issues, but if you got those hot temperatures, you know, that upper layer is going to dry out fast, right? And there's more issues with crusting as well. So then you're having to keep it from, you know, staying that way so that seedling can break through. So it's multiple things going on at once besides just the temperature effects.
Fred, you want to weigh in on that?
As I said before, seed and seedling vigor are related, but I could envision, when you ask the question, something could have a wonderful seed vigor, but be susceptible to thrips or highly susceptible to certain seedling disease, so that even susceptible to hail, it wouldn't have very good seedling vigor. So they can separate out.
Okay. I know Arkansas is like 80% irrigated production, right?
Right.
Is that center pivot or fur irrigated or mixed?
It's mixed. I think my guess is we're a higher percent of furrow irrigated. Okay. Probably 80% of our irrigated acres are furrow.
Can you water up cotton by fur irrigation?
No, but I did it once. I've always thought that you couldn't, but we planted test plots here at Kaiser few years ago, and it was just sitting there in the dry dirt with no. And I said, well, let's try it. And we irrigated, and it came right up. So the cotton is very sensitive to oxygen depletion in the soil. And that's the real key. If you can get water on and off and get it, then you make it do it. But it's a tricky business with, I think with furrow irrigation, it's kind of a last resort for us.
How about, do you see any, what we call dusting in? By that, I mean, in the South.
And then wait to rain?
Yes, you put it in and hope. You know, it's too dry to germinate. You put it in, hope you're going to get a rain, hope you don't get a light rain, and get enough to get it up. But you're getting late in the planting window, so you got to go. It always makes me cringe, but do y'all do any of that?
Very little. I know soybean folks will tend to try that more than in cotton.
Yeah, the first I heard about it was when I came here. And it's not uncommon. I'll hear somebody do it every year. And of course, you were here longer than I've been here, Steve. But like I say, that's something that I hear about pretty regular here in Georgia. They'll plant it. They'll keep it planted shallow. They'll keep it in those, you know, it's basically in really dry conditions so that it doesn't start germination, right? If it's just enough rain to start germination, then the plants, you know, if it's not enough to drive that root growth and get that plant out of the ground, then you're out of luck, right? But yeah, in theory, if it's dry enough, then yeah, it shouldn't start germination. And then if you get a decent rainfall event, you know, that may work out. But I don't do it, but I know that growers do this on I don't want to say regular basis, but I know it's not uncommon.
More typical, what we see here under those conditions, if they're pivot, they'll just go ahead and plant and, you know, put water to get it up, which is a great advantage of pivot. If they're furrow, they may just do a pre-irrigation. They'll water the field down and let it dry enough to then plant into that wet soil.
I hate to introduce this subject, but soybean, I hate to talk about soybeans, but my understanding is in soybeans, if they are put in hot ground like we're talking about, that they're going to deteriorate and they're not going to come up. Whereas cotton, once the moisture comes, it's going to come up. Do y'all agree with that statement?
Well, like I say, there are a few years where crusting or no crusting, and we had irrigation and it didn't matter. So I mean, we can still limit emergence with high temperatures, but I wouldn't say it's very common, right? I would say as long as you have the water, we'd do pretty good. We had one year where it was pretty, that seemed to be the drivers, it's, you know, after I got here.
My question is, it seems like soybeans are more vulnerable to that than cotton.
I don't know anything about soybeans.
The only thing relevant to that, soybeans are more tolerant to oxygen depletion than cotton, as I understand. And so that might fit into that. It's all this, what John said, the timing of the water, the timing, it all comes down to that.
Okay, but one final topic maybe is, we've alluded to the issue of root development. What else do y'all want to say about genetics, variety, and germination and so forth with root development? Anything you want to add in that realm?
All I'll say is what little bit of root work that I have done is, you know, when we look at those cultivar averages, and this is just picking a subset of what's in the on-farm trials. So we're not talking about extreme genetic difference. You know, we're dealing with pretty elite stuff, right? We're dealing with the best stuff that's available to the growers. And even within that, we saw, and that's what's really interesting to me. We tend to focus on the above ground parts of the plant, right? Yeah, it's easy. There's a reason. Yeah. But we saw, you know, up to like 67% difference, you know, across these cultivars in their root growth. And of course, that's when we put them, I'm talking about an average across both the cool temperatures and the warm temperatures. But that's pretty substantial in my mind, you know, and we're not usually capturing that.
Well, I think I mentioned before, we did some work on selecting lines that have better lateral root development in the seedling stage. And remember the old McNair 235 was a prolific lateral root developer, but that doesn't necessarily translate into how well it takes up water and nutrient just because it's got a lot of lateral roots. It just means it's got more lateral roots. And so that there's some, I started digging in that hole and I decided that's a complicated issue. And it's, I think there's a lot. I think it's a gold mine for us if we could really get there, be able to characterize it more, and perhaps with some of these new techniques that can do better. But it was very eye opening for me. But I, if we get more lateral roots, that, well, what we started, I was working on back with old trifluralin or treflin. And, you know, one of the big concerns when we use treflin is that it would prune lateral roots. So you plant your seed about an inch or so, it would come out. And, you know, we're supposed to be getting our treflin right up there, kind of above that, but it got a lot lower. I think we were getting a lot of seedling root damage at that point with the trifluralin. We've, you know, found some that were more tolerant to that. That was kind of the driving issue that got us interested in that. But what we found is that using, we use some very low dosage rates of trifluralin in greenhouse culture, and there was not an interaction between number of lateral roots treat and untreat. So what the treflin did was to give us a testing environment that we could select for higher lateral roots in treated soil that would should give us a lot more in untreated soil. So anyway, that was a long time ago, and we did find a had a student work on found a pretty good inheritance pattern for that.
So what would y'all say are the most important environmental factors that determine seedling root growth? I will interject and say that our use of pre-emergence herbicides is far less today than it was, because we used to use rates that I don't think people today could stand, or it's we if we didn't get injured, we didn't get control. And so we were always on the edge. And so we had injury, but so that was a factor. But any other factors that affect seedling root growth?
All the standard ones that you would expect, right? Temperature, moisture, specific, and I'm not saying the high temperature, right? Low temperature tends to be the issue in the early season, and well, and more, maybe more so in the mid-south. But again, we do get low temperature conditions, and I mean, some of that root work, I mean, we had like 75% reductions in root growth just with it being at, for example, 65 degrees versus, the being in the 80s, right? Which, I mean, that's not surprising. It accelerates the rate of development. So if you're measuring at the same time, plants at the higher temperature are going to grow those roots a lot faster.
Certainly don't want any type of hard pan type of issues. And then what you mentioned earlier is those where you have a messed up taproot, and that changes the whole dynamics and structure of that whole root system. And I'm not sure it's all that bad, but it's just I recall again many years ago I was asked to be a judge at a county fair in down in Mississippi, and these different people would bring in their cotton plants, and I was supposed to judge which one was the best cotton plant. Obviously, I looked at how many bows there were, but I started noticing just about, and these were plants they pulled up off the end of the road. Just about every one of them had a messed up tap root system, and I that always just kind of stuck in my mind. I'm not sure there's a well, there's a correlation. I don't know if there's a meaning to that, but that just always struck me as kind of interesting.
The corkscrew correlation.
Right. I mean, if you that lateral, it's not going to have as deep, but you probably will end up with more lateral roots. Now, is that good or bad? That's according to what's going on in that field.
Well, hopefully this has been a helpful follow-up discussion about seed quality. I do appreciate our listeners joining us on the Cotton Specialist Corner podcast. We do appreciate Cotton Incorporated and their sponsorship of this effort, and especially appreciate the insights of Fred Moreland and John Snyder. So thanks, one and all.